Hello, I'm David Crow, and this is The Infectious Myth. Thank you for being a listener. If you've got a comment or want to suggest a future guest, you can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And we did get a little bit of feedback, and before I get to our guest today, who's Dr. James Fetzer, I would like to just briefly summarize some of the feedback that we got. After the last show on shaken baby syndrome, I got an email from a lady named Susan who said, "I really like how you listen. You give your guests time to talk and ask respectful yet very direct and insightful questions to probe the basis for what they say. I wish more programs would adopt that model." She also shared the story of a close relative who she considers to be the perfect mother who was accused, luckily received a light sentence, and is now back home being the perfect mom again. I can't give any details, but the description of the devastation to the family was horrible. Luckily, they stuck together and with some lucky breaks got through it. Helen Lauer, a professor at the University of Ghana, wrote about the SARS episode. Listening to your SARS broadcast and how you hone in on the way fear moves an epidemic and how the Iraq war obsession literally protected Americans for a while from the economic devastation that wrecked Toronto during the epidemic, I thought that what I'm saying here about the dependency upon and patterns of collusion can also be part of analyzing the persistence of scientific dogma in place of actual scientifically legitimate and durable foundations in truth. Finally, Carla asked, "Thank you for producing informative shows. Would it be possible for you to do a show on the different medical tests which are supposed to identify the presence of a virus or illness? What are the pros or cons? Are some tests better than others?" And I'll certainly look for an expert on medical testing. Hopefully I can identify that person and interview them sometime in the future. But today we're going to take a break from talking about medical corruption, errors, and fatal foolishness. We're going to talk about similar situations in other walks of life. My guest today has the modern badge of honor that all free thinkers should have, a scathing Wikipedia page, one that calls him a conspiracy theorist. It also notes that he's a philosopher of science who, since the late 1970s, has worked on assessing and clarifying the forms and foundations of scientific explanation, probability in science, philosophy of mind, and philosophy of cognitive science, especially artificial intelligence and computer science. He's done a lot in the area of computers, notably founding the journal Minds and Machines and editing it for 11 years. Professor Fetzer taught at the University of Kentucky from 1970, receiving the first Distinguished Teaching Award from the students there in 1973. He also taught at the universities of Virginia, Cincinnati, North Carolina, and South Florida. And when he retired in 2006, he was a full professor at the University of Minnesota. The interests that offend the anonymous Wikipedia editors are in the JFK assassination, 9/11, and the 2002 death of Senator Paul Wellstone. Welcome to the show, Professor Fetzer.
Oh, David, thanks very much. I'm very pleased to be here. I have responded to Wikipedia's savaging of my page by publishing articles about it. The latest wasn't the first time, but it was by far the most severe. And if you look under James H. Fetzer Wikipedia not, that will be in relation to an earlier attempt. And then I think this latest, the title is Wikipedia Flexes Its Zionist Orientation Again. And what I have done, David, is show you the state of the entry before and the state of the entry after it was whacked. In this last case, they took all of my research on conspiracy theories, all about JFK, 9/11, Wellstone, Sandy Hook, and so forth, which was really quite extensive, elaborate, detailed, and very thoroughly documented, and they just took it all out,
Right. That's unfortunately not uncommon. Like, I go to Wikipedia quite often, you know, if I need to know the population of a city or you know, something like that, then Wikipedia is a reasonable source for what you might call factual information. But anything that is the least bit controversial, especially if it goes against major interests such as governments, drug companies, the military-industrial complex, or whatever, is likely to be dominated by one side. And it's usually the side that has an opinion that's diverse from mine. So I don't think you need to feel bad about having a savaged Wikipedia page. I don't think too many.
Well, I liked your introduction saying that that was a badge of honor. I appreciate that. My impression is that it's a Zionist intel op, and they want to promote the interests of Israel. They don't care about the United States, and they most certainly don't care about whether what they're providing in terms of information is accurate or complete. In fact, it benefits them to be partial and inaccurate, especially when their policy is to rely on secondary sources rather than primary. Any professional scholar is taught from the beginning of the importance of primary sources, so you can verify what the subject actually said or did not say. In this case, Wikipedia places primacy on secondary.
Right. I wondered about that because when I started studying controversial topics, my first controversial topic was the theory that HIV causes AIDS, and the people who don't believe that, one of the first things I did was to start to go to the primary sources, because I was reading all of these documents that were by people who were pro the theory and anti the theory, and I was thinking, I'm taking these people on their word, and they have two divergent opinions, so unless I go to the primary sources, I can't straighten this out. And I went to the primary sources and aligned more and more with the critics of the mainstream theory. So what's the justification for Wikipedia relying only on secondary sources?
Well, it enables it to function more effectively as a disinformation site because they can find secondary sources that exhibit any attitude they want to display. For example, Josiah Thompson has been a longtime critic of my work on JFK. I have exposed him as a fraud. I wasn't the first to nail him as a disinfo op within the JFK community. That honor fell to Vince Scalandria. But the fact of the matter is they will go out for, get one op citing another op, and then they can make it look as though you have a convergence of two independent views when, in fact, it's an effort in collaboration to discredit someone who's doing work they don't like.
Yeah, I remember there was a science PhD who was, secretly funded by the Chlorine Institute, which represents all of the big chemical companies that produce chlorinated compounds like Dow and all of those. And, he would write, anytime somebody wrote anything negative about a chlorinated chemical, he would write a letter without revealing his funding source, saying that there's problems with this research and it doesn't really show what you think it shows, and it doesn't really matter whether what he said was true or not, because the chemical companies could always pull it out and say, well, look, this professor says that this research was shoddy, and then they can move on from there, and nobody has to actually look beneath his statements to see whether it's actually really true.
Well, let me give you a perfect illustration, David. One of the editors of Wikipedia is a professor at Marquette University by the name of John McAdams, who is perhaps the world's leading defender of the Lee Harvey Oswald lone assassin theory, which has been dismantled dozens of times. But that doesn't inhibit him from attacking me. I mean, just to offer one illustration, he would defend the magic bullet theory. Well, I traveled to Cambridge and took apart the magic bullet theory and then published it in a peer-reviewed international journal entitled Reasoning About Assassinations. We know where JFK was hit in the back. It was not the base of the back of the neck. The bullet did not traverse his neck. Indeed, that turns out to be anatomically impossible because cervical vertebrae intervene. So what I did in that article, in that presentation at Cambridge, was go through all the evidence we have, the shirt, the jacket, the autopsy diagram, the FBI sketch, the president's personal physician's death certificate, all of which locate the wound 5.5 inches below the collar, just to the right of the spinal column. I go on and show that even the Warren Commission staff believe that was the location of the hit, because the original theory, before it was discovered that one shot had missed and injured a distant bystander by the name of James Tague, was that Jack had been hit in the back, Connolly had been hit in the back, then Jack had been hit in the back of the head, killing him. Well, even the Warren Commission staff reenactment photographs show a big patch for the stand-in for JFK on the back, not the back of the neck, on the back. There's even one which is my favorite from the entire collection of JFK photographs of the young Arlen Specter holding a pointer, illustrating the trajectory the magic bullet would have to have taken were the magic bullet theory true. And you look below his hand 4 or 5 inches, and there's a big patch on the stand-in, meaning that a photograph that's supposed to illustrate the magic bullet theory actually refutes it.
Right. So basically, the magic bullet theory says that one bullet hit how many people and did what damage?
Well, it turns out that Gerald Ford, who was then a junior member of the commission, had the wound to his back redescribed from his uppermost back, which was already an exaggeration, to the base of the back of the neck, to support the claim that the bullet had come in the back of the neck, passed through the neck without hitting any bony structures, exited the throat, gone into the back of John Connolly, shattered a rib, exited his chest, hit his right wrist, and wound up impaled in his left thigh. Now, when you understand that the magic bullet theory is impossible because a bullet, to begin with, didn't enter the back of his neck, and second, if it had, the official trajectory is anatomically impossible, where David W. Mantic, MD, PhD, the world's leading expert on the medical evidence, took a patient with similar chest and neck dimensions, created a CAT scan, and sought to plot the official trajectory encountering cervical vertebrae, making it not even anatomically possible. Because once you recognize that, you understand that you have to account for the wound to the throat and the wounds to Connolly on the basis of other shots and other shooters. Connolly was actually hit anywhere from 1 to 3 times. Even Michael Badden, who was the head of the HSCA medical panel, when it reinvestigated the case in 1977-78, acknowledged that if the magic bullet theory were false, then there had to have been at least 6 shots from 3 different directions. Well, the magic bullet theory is false. It's provably false and not even anatomically possible. And there were at least 6 shots from 3 different directions. Just to recount, Jack had that hit on the back. He had a shot to the throat that passed through the windshield. Then 2 hits to his head after the driver, William Greer, pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt. That's 4 in Jack. The shot that missed and injured the distant bystander, Tag, is a 5th. And then at least 1 shot in Connolly is 6. So that Batten had it right. If the magic bullet theory is false, then there had to be at least 6 shots from 3 different directions.
Right. And if that's the case, then Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't in 3 different places at once.
David, it's even more astonishing than that. We've actually proven, and I've published at least a dozen articles about this, that he was captured in a very famous photograph taken by AP photographer James Ike Alchins. It shows the limousine during the shooting. Jack is clutching his throat. You can actually see the bullet hole in the windshield where his left ear would be if his left ear were visible. And in the background in the doorway area, there's a figure that seems to be extending out looking at what's going on. Based upon his height, weight, build, shirt, and undershirt, we've been able to identify that person as having been Lee Oswald. The claim was made it was a co-worker by the name of Billy Lovelady. But Billy appears to be standing by Lee with his arms upraised. Billy always said it was odd they'd be confused because he was 2 to 3 inches shorter and 15 to 20 pounds heavier. Well, this figure is 2 to 3 inches shorter and 15 to 20 pounds heavier. Plus, he's wearing a short sleeve shirt. Now, it's fascinating that Billy Lovelady was asked by the FBI to come into their office in Dallas on 29 February 1964 to show them the shirt he'd been wearing. He came in wearing a short sleeve, red and white, vertically striped shirt, and they duly photographed him and sent back to Hoover the statement that this proved that Billy was in the doorway, not hoping that that Edgar wouldn't notice the discrepancy between being in the doorway to the side of doorman and being doorman himself, which he manifestly was not. Judith Berry Baker, by the way, has sealed the deal by studying photographs of Billy Lovelady, not in his red and white vertically striped shirt, but in a black and red checkered shirt. And she's been able to do a pixel comparison of both the shirt that Lee was wearing when he was arrested, this black and white checkered shirt, and the shirt on the man in the doorway. And she found there's a very close match between Oswald's shirt, but a complete mismatch between the shirt Billy Lovelady was wearing, according to the apologists who want to take him out of the red and white short sleeve shirt, which is so obviously not the shirt on the man in the doorway.
So what do you think Oswald was doing in Dallas? Like, was he some kind of a patsy or something if he wasn't responsible for the assassination?
Oh, of course, he was set up as the patsy, but he'd been working undercover for the United States since he was recruited by the Office of Naval Intelligence when he was a recruit at the depot in San Diego, where I subsequently served as a series commander with 15 DIs and 300 recruits under my command, and the same rifle range where he took his marksmanship training at Edson Range Camp Pendleton. He went from the San Diego to Atsugi, Japan, which was our most highly classified base. It was the source of the overflights across the Soviet Union using the U-2 planes. And because he was a radar operator, after he got a hardship discharge on the ground, his mother was in ill health. He actually turned around and immediately made a pseudo-defection to the Soviet Union, apparently at behest of the CIA, to give them information about the overflights. So that while Eisenhower and Khrushchev were about to have a summit meeting that was intended to reduce Cold War tensions, in fact, Khrushchev accused Eisenhower of the U.S. spying on the Soviet Union. Eisenhower denied it, and Khrushchev was able to produce Gary Powers, the pilot, and parts of the plane. Now, it turns out that it may not have been the information that Oswald would have been able to give them about the altitude that brought the plane down, enabled them to shoot it down, because L. Fletcher Prouty, who is represented by the figure Colonel X in Oliver Stone's film JFK, who was a real person, the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA for covert ops, told his assistant, Len Osanek, that in fact they'd shorted the fuel in the plane. They'd fixed the gauge to make it look full, but actually it had only a partial tank, a gas, so that it was going to come down in any case, whether they shot it down or not. Francis Powers was going to be left holding the bag. And when Lee Oswald returned to the United States after having married the niece of a KGB colonel, of all things, a fetching young woman by the name of Maria, he was not treated as a traitor. He was actually given money by a CIA front organization to relocate. Maria wound up in Dallas. He wound up in New Orleans. And now he was working with, the U.S. intel agents down there, particularly a fellow named Guy Bannister, who was supposed to be former FBI, but appears to have been carrying on intel ops. And Oswald was being sheep-dipped there as a pro-Castro communist sympathizer. So that, for example, on one occasion, he handed out pamphlets and got into an altercation with anti-Castro Cubans who thought he was betraying them. And would you believe, David, there just happened to be a TV camera there to record it? I mean, this altercation lasted, maybe 30 seconds. But they got it on film, and they put it on television, and then later Lee was interviewed
saying
he was a Marxist but not a communist and so forth.
Right. So the point was to paint Oswald as a communist sympathizer as some kind of a cover or something for whatever he was supposed to be doing.
That's absolutely right. I mean, they were going to pin the assassination on him, and the American people were supposed to rise up and demand that we invade Cuba and take out Castro. It didn't play out that way, but that was the idea and why they were giving him this new persona in New Orleans.
Oswald obviously didn't know this, right? Like, he was being used. Like, nobody told him that we're going to paint you as a communist sympathizer. We're going to pretend that you shot Kennedy, and then we're going to kill you.
No, of course, he did not. He was not aware of that until after he'd been arrested and all that.
So Oswald must have thought he was doing something different.
Well, he was actually at the time working as an informant for the FBI. Wagoner Carr, who was the Attorney General of Texas, launched his own investigation and discovered almost immediately that he had informant number 179 and was being paid $200 a month right up to the assassination, which may explain the bizarre anomaly that the federal government claims it can't disclose or obtain the federal tax forms on the alleged assassin of the 35th president of the United States. Obviously, it's because they would reveal he was being paid as an informant for the FBI, which makes him a most unlikely candidate to have assassinated the president of the United States.
Well, and if an informant for the FBI did assassinate the president of the United States, you have to ask him questions about the FBI.
Lyndon Johnson was a principal facilitator. I mean, to get the big picture on the assassination, David, you have to draw distinctions between the sponsors, the individuals and groups who wanted him out, who included the CIA because he was threatening to shatter it into 1,000 pieces, the Joint Chiefs because he had not invaded Cuba, contrary to their unanimous recommendation. He'd signed an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union, contrary to their unanimous opposition. Now he is pulling our forces out of Vietnam, where they believed a stand had to be taken against international godless communism. The anti-Castro Cubans, who falsely believed JFK had abandoned them at the Bay of Pigs. The mafia wanted Bobby to back off his crackdown on organized crime. The Eastern establishment surrounding the Fed was concerned because Jack had directed the Department of Treasury to print United States notes, 100 million or more, to circumvent the Fed, so that he thought was absurd the government of the United States should be paying interest to a consortium of private banks to print the currency of the United States. And the Texas oilmen were worried because he was going to cut the oil depletion allowance, and Israel was upset because Jack was at loggerheads with David Ben-Gurion, its first PM and a principal in the founding of the State of Israel. Ben-Gurion wanted Israel to develop nuclear weapons, which JFK adamantly opposed. And then from the sponsors, you have the mechanics on the ground. I've identified six different shooters and their supervisors and coordinators, who included George H.W. Bush and Edward Lansdale. But in between were the facilitators. Lyndon Johnson was the key principal player in organizing the assassination. In fact, Billy Saul Estes, the Texas Wheeler dealer, who earned a lot of money for Lyndon Connolly and their cronies and scams that he was pulling off, knew these guys personally, and told a French investigative journalist, William Raymond, that Lyndon had sent Cliff Carter, his chief administrative assistant, down to Dallas to make sure the arrangements for the assassination were in place. And he also knew Malcolm Mack Wallace, who was Lyndon's personal hitman, who murdered a dozen people for Lyndon, including one of his own sisters, who was one of the shooters as well. Lyndon and J. Edgar were very close. They lived next door in Georgetown, in Washington. And Edgar was the godfather to one of Lyndon's daughters. They both hated the Kennedys, who were planning, you know, not to run again with Lyndon and to retire Edgar. So Lyndon created the assassination and so forth, Hoover used the FBI to help cover it up.
I'm not an expert in this era of American history, but a couple of things. First of all, I thought that the Kennedy patriarch was pretty well tied up with the mafia. So why was Kennedy going after the mafia?
I think that's a misunderstanding. Joe Kennedy learned that Prohibition was going to be ended and got a lock on the importation of scotch from Scotland. So he made a whole lot of money. He had been a bootlegger, and he did have some contacts with the underground, but that wasn't true of Bobby and Jack. And while you hear these reports that there was an agreement with the mob to make sure that Chicago went for Jack in Illinois and therefore the election, Jack or Bobby would never have stood for that. Whether Joe did that is another question. I don't put that beyond him. But Bobby and Jack were going after the mob because the mob was violating the laws of the United States, and the Attorney General of the United States believed that he should enforce the law.
Right. Another thing, I just read a book on American nuclear accidents, which has a lot of history about the nuclear weapons program of the United States, and it describes quite a bit about the people. The movie, I think the most accurate history of that time that I've seen is Dr. Strangelove, because some of the people around JFK at the time who were sort of promoting nuclear war seemed to be certifiably insane. And really,
the colonel there, who's obsessed with bodily fluids and all that, and who is an extreme war hawk, appears to have been modeled on Curtis LeMay, who was the head of the Air Force at the time, who was even present at JFK's autopsy at Bethesda smoking a cigar. I mean, he was an extreme right winger who would have been among the very first to want to take Jack out of office.
The nuclear weapons industry, or the nuclear weapons branches of the American military really wanted to try their toys out, and they really didn't like a president telling them that they weren't going to drop any more nukes, and they couldn't nuke Moscow, and they couldn't nuke whatever else they felt that they wanted to. But I mean, it's insane because, you know, the consequences of dropping one nuclear bomb are completely unpredictable. I mean, let alone the physical cost. But you don't know what the other side is going to do. You don't really know how successful they're going to be. And you don't know how successful your program is going to be. So only a completely insane person would push to drop a bomb when there was any other alternatives left over.
Well, I'm inclined to agree with you. We had a whole succession of presidents who would never have held the office but for the death of JFK, including, of course, Lyndon, but also Richard Nixon, but also Gerald Ford, but also George Herbert Walker Bush, who, notice, would have acceded to the presidency had the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan been successful, where I am personally of the opinion that he was involved in arranging that assassination attempt. And, of course, eventually W, who never would have been taken seriously for the position had he not been the son of a previous president, but where it appears the whole election in Florida was rigged and that the Supreme Court was somehow under duress, you know, some kind of extortion taking place to get involved in a case that was, strictly speaking, in terms of the Constitution, a state issue for the Florida state legislature to resolve. There was no role for the Supreme Court to play there.
Right. One of my previous guests pointed out that vice presidents are rarely assassinated in the U.S., and I think what you're saying is that if there is an assassination, you probably want to look at the vice president as the most likely candidate.
Sure. I mean, among those who were involved or up close in relation to key players, I got to know Madeline Duncan Brown, who had an affair with Lyndon that began in 1948. She bore him a son, Stephen, in 1950, not his only child out of wedlock, but his only male offspring. And on New Year's Eve, 6 weeks after the assassination, they had a rendezvous at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas, where she confronted him with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved, since no one stood to gain more personally. Lyndon blew up at her and told her that the CIA and the oil boys had decided that Jack had to be taken out.
Right. Well, I guess the question is, I mean, is it that vice presidents are lusting after the top position since they're so close? Or is it that if you're an interest in the United States and you don't get what you want out of the president, then the best option is to displace the president and manipulate the vice president?
Well, David, this appears to have been the plan from the time when he forced himself on the ticket in Los Angeles, 1960. Jack had already extended the invitation to run as his vice presidential mate to Stuart Symington in Missouri, but gave him overnight to think about it. Lyndon wasn't on their long list, much less their short. But Bobby went by the Johnson suite to issue a pro forma invitation and was astonished when Lyndon jumped on it. Using information he obtained from Edgar, he threatened to expose that Jack had had dalliances with beautiful women who were spies for other countries, one being East Germany, that he had Addison's disease and wasn't expected to live a long, healthy life. And moreover, if he were not on the ticket, then as majority leader in the Senate, he'd bottle up any legislative proposals coming down from the White House, would be dead on arrival. Jack and Bobby wrestled with it, tried to figure out a way to get around this, but it was impossible. When a supporter of Lyndon burst into the Johnson suite angry because LBJ was going to help JFK become elected, Bobby Baker took him into a bedroom and explained what they had in mind. And the fellow came out all smiles, saying he thought that was an excellent plan.
So some of the organizations that you think benefited from the JFK assassination, The CIA wanted more tension. I presume the entire U.S. military wanted more Cold War tension.
Well, the CIA was worried because Jack was threatening to shatter it into 1,000 pieces. I mean, he actually said that. It was after the Bay of Pigs where he was massively deceived. He was told that there would be a popular uprising when they landed. And that they would be able to take over the island relatively effortlessly. The fact of the matter is that Fidel had been notified as to the date of the landing, probably even the location, which was a swampy area. All the ammunition was on one ship, which blew up before they got their forces aboard. He was able to round them up effortlessly. It turned out that the Soviet Union had learned the date and had passed it on to Castro, and the CIA already knew that they knew we were coming, but didn't tell the commander-in-chief, who undoubtedly would have called it off. But after Jack looked into this and realized they'd put him in the unpalatable position of having to choose between sending in the Marines or getting egg on his face, where they were confident he'd send in the Marines instead, he took egg on his face, which they hadn't anticipated at all.
Oh, I see. Right. Because he realized that it was going to be, having been lied to once, he was probably listening to people who say, oh, yeah, send in the Marines and it'll be over in a couple of days, and probably thinking, yeah, like, we'll still be there a couple of years from now and we'll be bringing body bags home.
Well, it's very interesting, David, that while, you know, some of these advisors were recommending the invasion of Cuba even after, that they already had tactical nuclear weapons. In fact, this is what led to the Cuban Missile Crisis. But, you know, they had these tactical nuclear weapons even before the invasion of the Bay of Pigs. It would have been a catastrophic if we attempted to invade Cuba. There's a bad book by a good man named Tom Hartman entitled Ultimate Sacrifice, and it's come out in his second edition, too, where he has a co-author by the name of Lamar Waldron that suggests that Jack was planning to invade Cuba again after all, that the mob learned of it and took out Jack and then used the threat to reveal his plan to invade Cuba again to box in Bobby. But that's simply absurd. Jack had given the word to the world that the U.S. would not invade Cuba again. There was no prospect of doing that. Even Robert McNamara acknowledged he'd never heard of such a plan. You couldn't have an invasion without the Secretary of Defense being aware. This is just complete poppycock, and I'm very disturbed that Tom Hartman was pulled into this. My review of Ultimate Sacrifice, which you can find online on Amazon.com, is entitled Ultimate Rubbish.
What you said I think is really important, because the Cuban Missile Crisis was when the Russians were building launching pads for ICBMs, I guess, in Cuba, but it turns out that there were already nuclear weapons on Cuba, so if there had been an invasion, and if those had been fired, there could have been devastation, like at least the city of Miami could have been erased from the earth or something like that.
Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to the next big interest that you have, which is 9/11. So from your point of view, and you're the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, so what are some of the biggest holes in the government's conspiracy theory about 9/11 in your opinion?
Well, everything we've been told by the government about 9/11 is false, except that the Twin Towers were there and now the Twin Towers aren't. There were no 19 Islamic hijackers. The phone calls from the planes were all fake. The planes weren't actually, none of the planes actually crashed on 9/11. It's very difficult for people who have never looked at the evidence to understand this. But for those who actually want to take a deeper look, a good place to begin might be my article on Veterans Today entitled Planes, No Planes, and Video Fakery, where no planes simply means that none of the official commercial carriers the government claims crashed actually crashed. It doesn't mean none of them were in the air. Indeed, we have evidence that two of them, Flight 93, was supposed to have crashed at Shanksville, was in the air. Pilots for 9/11 Truth have done air ground communications research and established that it was in the air that day, but that it was over Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, after it had allegedly crashed in Shanksville. And pilots has also been able to establish that Flight 175, which purportedly hit the South Tower, was also in the air that day, but that it was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, long after it had allegedly hit the South Tower. In fact, Americans seem to be very, very slow on the uptake when it turned out that a half a dozen or more of the alleged suicide hijackers were alive and well the following day and spoke with members of the British press. In his masterful book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, David Ray Griffin makes their emergence the very first point. Because if the suicide hijackers, and this included Mohammed Atta, who was supposed to have been their leader and been aboard Flight 175, turn up alive and well, then that means that the planes didn't crash. that they weren't killed, and in fact, they weren't even aboard them. I mean, this is, it's so devastating to the official account. But to understand what was really
question,
going
on.
David, go ahead.
So you say that Flight 93 was in the air at the time it supposedly crashed, and also Flight 175. those flights had passengers on them. So what happened to those passengers?
Well,
and what happened to the airplane?
Went to their destination. The fact of the matter is we have FAA registration data. I have it right in hand, showing that the planes that were used for Flights 93 and 175 were not deregistered or formally taken out of service until 28 September 2005. We also have Bureau of Transportation statistics records showing that flights 11 and 77 weren't even scheduled that day, which raised the following two questions. How can planes that weren't even in the air have crashed on 9/11? And how can planes that crashed on 9/11 have still been in the air 4 years later?
Well, just because registration records are taken, still not taken off the books, it doesn't necessarily mean the planes are in service. I mean, did somebody have pictures of those physical airplanes after 9/11?
David, the government has a lot of power to cover these things up. You got to appreciate when they make a mistake of the magnitude I'm describing here, when the government's own documents show that two of the planes that were allegedly used on 9/11 were actually still in the air 4 years later, you have to understand that that's a gold nugget. This is like doing mining out in the Sierras, right? When you discover that the Bureau of Transportation Statistics records did not originally show Flight 11 or 77 in the air. It's rather like the discovery that the U.S. Geological Survey did dust sample analysis from all over Ground Zero and found all kinds of elements, including barium and strontium, uranium, lithium, lanthanum, tritium, that would not have been present had this not been a nuclear event. Where there are now about a dozen articles, half of them from Gordon Duff on Veterans Today, that display the evidence we have that this was a nuclear event, some of which comes from the International Atomic Energy Agency and others from the Sandia Labs, which actually were involved in developing the weapons, but where the weapons were in the American arsenal and then during the George H.W. Bush administration given to Israel. So Israel had some 35 Davy Crockett warheads taken from the American arsenal under George H.W. Bush, which they took back to Israel and reworked and brought into the United States, apparently by submarine, to be used on 9/11.
Let's go back a little bit here. Okay, so you're saying there was... I've never heard, I don't know a huge amount about 9/11, but I've never heard anybody hypothesize that there were some kind of nuclear weapon. I mean, this is not a nuclear explosion, so what kind of weapon are you talking about?
Well, you're saying it wasn't a nuclear explosion because you're not familiar with the varieties and types of nuclear explosions. This appears to have been a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes that were neutron bombs that have a dialable radius so that you can actually... For example, if they were connected to the core columns, you could give it a 100-foot radius. Buildings were 200 feet on a side. That would be a 200-foot diameter. I have suggested as a model for thinking about this that they, if you consider the North Tower, which was 110 floors, that if they were taking out, say, 1 10-floor cube per second using these mini or micro nukes, which can be directed, in this case, directed upward. So you're taking them out from the top down to try to simulate what's going to be palmed off as a collapse when it's no collapse of any kind.
Right.
Then that would take, if you're doing 1 10-floor cube per second, that would take 11 seconds. That happens to correspond with the government's own estimate. And in the South Tower, because the top three cubes are tilted to one side, were taken out as one, that would be 9 seconds. In addition to, the disappearance of so much of those buildings, which would have required some enormous source of energy. I mean, there's no collapse going on here.
Right.
What we see in the gross observable evidence, David, is that these buildings are being blown apart in every direction from the top down. They're being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. And when it's over... they're destroyed to ground level. In fact, Father Frank Morales from St. Mark's Episcopal Church came on my shows twice and explained how they were actually destroyed below ground level. Now, Gordon Duff has gone into a whole lot of the technical explanation about how it was done, and it has published some really fascinating photographs of the rock, the bedrock in which the buildings were constructed, showing how it, you know, it's virtually clean as a whistle. It shows all the signs of having been, you know, as it were, virtually polished by the extent of the detonations that were observed, in this case, even in the sub-basement. In other words, the steel in the building was 6 inches thick in the sub-basement, got 5'4", up to about a quarter inch at the very top, so that the buildings, like the North Tower, could not even have possibly collapsed, just given its design. Chuck Baldwin, who's a retired high school physics and chemistry teacher, that made calculations and discovered that the top 14 floors of the North Tower, which allegedly collapsed and caused a pancake of the rest of the building, only represent 1.4% of the mass of the steel. Well, it's ridiculous to think 1.4% of the mass of the steel could overcome the lower 98.6. And in fact, John Stilling, who was a principal engineer, explained how the buildings were designed with a safety factor of 20, meaning that every floor could actually carry 20 times what it was going to be carrying with a live load, which means not only the empty building, but occupied by personnel, workers, computers, desks, you know, and
so
all that.
What you're saying is that the higher up a building goes, the lighter the construction, because it has to bear less load, right? You don't build...
If you built
with the same thickness as at the bottom, then the building would be too heavy.
That's right. That's right. And the point I was coming up to is that it appears as though under the envelope of all the cascading debris, that larger nukes were used to take out the heaviest part of the building, you know, coming upward. It's like an umbrella, right? You have all this debris coming down from the outside of the umbrella. Meanwhile, there's an explosion going right up the handle of the umbrella to polish off the most massive part of the 47 core columns.
All right. But, okay, a couple of questions related to this, because the theory I had heard was that the building had been rigged with thermite to cut the beams, and then once the beams are cut, obviously gravity takes the building down. So what happened to that theory?
Well, it's actually been dispatched years ago. I did research with T. Mark Hightower, who's a chemical engineer, on the theory of nanothermite. It's an incendiary. It emits bright light and intense temperature, but it doesn't have explosive force, which is produced by the rapid expansion of gases. So, you know, even if you assume that thermite were used to cut bolts or what have you, then you'd have to have a massive pile of debris. I mean, look at Building 7. Building 7 was 47 floors. It came down in a classic controlled demolition. The building is not blowing apart in every direction. All the floors are falling at the same time. And when it's over, there's a stack of debris equal to about 12% of the height of the original, or in that case, 5.5 floors. Now, if you had something comparable going on with the Twin Towers, then you would have had a stack of debris equal to 12% of the height of 110 floors, which would have been about 14 floors, or two or even three times as much as the... as Building 7, but it's not there. Those buildings are actually destroyed, as Father Frank Morales observed, below ground level.
How high was the pile after the collapse of the Twin Towers?
Well, in its footprint, it was zero. That's the point I'm making.
Yeah, that's something
and we have,
I have
and we
never...
have a photographic confirmation. One of my favorites, David, is a photograph looking down on Building 6, which had this enormous gouged-out center. And in the background to the left, you can see this pile of debris from Building 7, 5.5 floors. And in the immediate foreground where Building 1 had stood, nothing. There's nothing there.
And
I just say, look, it's... don't feel bad. You haven't spent the kind of time, you know, that I have with the kind of experts to whom I have had access in looking at all this stuff. Because if you don't get deeply into it, it's easy to be taken in by one or another theory about how it was done. But the nanothermite theory won't wash. In fact, just to demonstrate that it's virtually non-explosive and can't possibly have blown the buildings apart by itself, Mark did a very thorough survey of the scientific literature. It's a law of material science that in order to blow a material apart, an explosive must have a detonation velocity equal to or greater than the speed of sound in that material. The speed of sound in concrete is 3,200 meters per second, and steel 6,100 meters per second. Well, the highest attributed detonation velocity for nanothermite is only 895 meters per second, which means you can't get there from there. And as I say, on the theory of collapse you're talking about, you'd have a massive pile of debris, which did not exist. It wasn't there.
Right. Well, not only that, if you don't blow the columns apart in a fraction of a second, then the building wouldn't necessarily collapse in a predictable way, because it would lose strength over a period of several seconds as it melted, and then it would probably fall over sideways, which would...
Well, let me tell you even more about that. There's a fellow who's been advocating the truss collapse theory that suggests all the floors fell one on another. But if all the floors fell one on another, then it would leave the 47 core column standing like the spindle of a 45 RPM player or an old 33. You can't have the floor fall without that massive 47 core column still standing, maybe even the external steel support columns. I mean, there were 240 of those, which provided, by the way, massive resistance to any strike by any plane. The physics of the videos we've been shown about those films are ridiculous, David. The Flight 175, where we have a whole lot of videos showing what is supposed to be, a Boeing 767 hitting the South Tower, are from the point of view of physics preposterous. And the plane disappears effortlessly into the building. It should have crumpled against the building, its wings, tail broken off, body seats, luggage fall into the ground. We've actually done frame-by-frame analysis advanced, David, and we've discovered that the plane passes its whole length into the building in the same number it passes its whole length through air, which is, of course, absurd, unless you assume that a 500,000-ton steel and concrete building is going to provide no more resistance to an aircraft in flight than air.
It's also an interesting point that I hadn't thought about. So, I mean, did people on the ground see? I mean, didn't people on the ground see airplanes flying into?
Well, that's very interesting. Yeah, that's been a much debated issue, because there have been three theories about how it was done, because there's some sort of fakery here. You have something that looks like a real plane, but it's performing feats that no real plane could perform. And we do have reports coming from witnesses, at least some of whom appear to be reliable. For example, I tracked down a fellow by the name of Scott Forbes, who had worked in the South Tower and who actually I interviewed him on my own show, the Real Deal, witnessed the 175 hit the South Tower. And I asked him to describe it. He said it was like the building swallowed the plane. Well, that's very much the impression you get, from those who report seeing a plane. Now, there are three theories. That it was done using computer-generated images or video compositing or a sophisticated hologram. And however much a hologram may sound far-fetched, the fact is that the first two, computer-generated images or video compositing, would not have created the image of a plane before it struck the tower, but only in broadcast footage after the event. So that as much as you believe that witnesses reported seeing what they took to be a real plane, which cannot have been a real plane, you're noting evidence that this had to be a projection of the image of a plane, which may explain, too, why it was traveling faster than is aerodynamically possible for a 767 at that altitude. There's a fellow in the UK by the name of Richard Hall who has a video study that you can find entitled Richard Hall's 3D Video Study of Flight 175, where he took all the videos he could find of Flight 175, and there were about 52 of them. He found about 27 of them were sufficiently precise that he could actually determine a location of the image of the plane and a time and sequence them. And then looked around and discovered that IST actually had, the National Transportation Safety Board, well, may have been NIST, had a similar study that they claim was based on radar data, but it didn't look to him like what they were citing was good enough to do it. He discovered belatedly that there actually was radar data, but when he compared their data points with his data points, which had coincided with the others in the government report, their data points were 1,400 feet to the right of his data points, suggesting that, those were for a real plane that was projecting the image of the plane that was flown into the South Tower. He said he replicated his study for the Flight 11 and found the same result. And we now have two. I was sent a page from a military manual showing a plane projecting the image of another plane, just as appears to have happened on 9/11. Where those who want to go into these issues in greater depth, go online to the Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference Part 2. In the Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference Part 2, I not only go through the evidence that it can't have been nanothermite that took out the towers, where the question becomes, David, if nanothermite can't have done it on its own, and you get apologists for A&E saying, yeah, well, they never claimed it was only nanothermite. They've never. The problem is they've never explained what it was in addition to nanothermite. I mean, toothpaste couldn't have done it either, but if you combine toothpaste with, say, mini nukes, then you have something. So they owe us an explanation, which has never been forthcoming. But in that same video study, which is only an hour long, I go through all the evidence that none of the 9/11 aircraft actually crashed, that all the all the crash sites were fabricated or faked, albeit in different ways. And the reasons for believing that of those three theories, actually the hologram theory is the one that is best supported by the evidence.
Right. Well, I hope that this discussion will get people to who are interested in this to look into some of those questions that you've raised and that I've raised. I have one other question, though, which is if it was a nuclear weapon of some kind and they found radioactive materials in the vicinity, wouldn't there have been people with radiation sickness in the vicinity? Like, how could a nuke go off and nobody's sick from radiation sickness? I mean, people got
When I organized the second of the two conferences that from scholars, where the first was held here in Madison in 2007, the second was held in Vancouver in 2012. Before the conference, my impression had been that there were 1,000 first responders who had reported odd kinds of cancer, multiple myeloma, esophageal, pancreatic, leukemia, and the like, which are typical effects of exposure to ionizing radiation.
Right, but radiation sickness
since then,
is
I've
not
learned
cancer.
From Gordon Duff that the actual number is 70,000. He's actually published an article in Veterans Today. That
right, but the
range
radiation
and variety of those who suffered from these kinds of debilitating effects is a great deal larger than we've heretofore supposed.
Right, but radiation sickness is not cancer. I mean, that's a long-term effect of exposure to radiation. But you know, radiation sickness, like after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, was basically the the breakdown of the body's ability to produce white blood cells and things like that, which causes within sometimes no effects within a few days, but within a week. People are getting, you know, are dying very quickly.
Well, the effects are going to vary depending on the type of weapon. I mean, these are fairly sophisticated weapons and, you know, much more recent. They're nothing comparable and don't have the same effects as Hiroshima or Nagasaki. So I just recommend, you know, go on to Veterans Today. Gordon Duff, he's got a series on, I think he calls it the Nuclear Education Series, where he talks about all of this. But if you just do a search, Gordon Duff, 70,000 harm by radiation, I'm sure the article will pop right up.
Right. And one of the controversial things, one of the reasons people have criticized you for your criticism of the government's 9/11 conspiracy theory is because they call you anti-Semitic because you've blamed Israel for playing a role in the conspiracy, in the government conspiracy to cause this event. I mean, do you think, what do you think Israel stood to gain by the 9/11 attacks?
Well, the whole business goes back to 1990-91 with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the military-industrial complex needed a new boogeyman. Israel wanted to deconstruct the modern Arab states that were serving as a counterbalance to its influence in the Middle East. 9/11 was arranged, and there's a tremendous amount of evidence of Israeli complicity. If you look at online, there's a massive website called Israel Did 9/11, All the Proof of the World. Israel cannot have done it alone. They had to have complicity of the CIA and the neocons in the Department of Defense, especially to, you know, manage faking the attack on the Pentagon. and making sure that no American fighters went out there in response to discover there were no aircraft to intercept. But it transformed American foreign policy from one in which, at least officially, we never attacked anyone who had attacked us first. We launched a series of illegal wars in the Middle East against Afghanistan initially, then subsequently against Iraq. We took out Libya shortly before the United Nations was going to bestow a humanitarian award on Muammar Gaddafi. And look at the mess we're in the Middle East. It was all to benefit Israel. None of this has any benefit for the United States at all. But Israel, which exerts a tremendous influence over our foreign policy, managed to get us in to do its dirty work against the whole host of its opponents and now wants to finish the job with Syria. It's a terrible situation, David.
It seems that the organizations that have benefited the most have been the American military-industrial complex, because without a war going on, they're not selling as many weapon systems and the bombs, which are pretty expensive. It's one thing to sell airplanes, but if an airplane's continually dropping bombs, then that's a lot more profitable than an airplane that is just flying around practicing.
Well, sure. I mean, I said that right off the bat. The military-industrial complex needed a new boogeyman. Well, what could be better than a shadowy terrorist organization, especially one in Muslim countries? You see, the Rothschild banking empire had not been able to get a foothold because in Islam, usury is frowned upon. So, you know, all this making money off of money that's so typical of the banks had kept them out of the Middle East. In fact, it was dumbfounding to me when I learned the first action of the alleged rebel group in Libya was to found a new central bank. I mean, that said to me something was not the way it is. Those who would like to pursue questions about motivation should check out several articles of mine, one entitled Peeling the 9/11 Onion, Layers of Plots Within Plots, which I co-authored with Preston James, where we go through all of the subtext, all of the attempts to deflect attention from those who were truly responsible onto other groups that were not.
Yes. I hope maybe you can email me a few major links, and I'll include them in the show notes.
Because that would be my pleasure, David. Thank you so much for having me.
We're coming to the end of our hour, so I'd just like to thank you for being with me for an hour, and I hope that people who are interested in JFK and 9/11 will follow up some of the links that I provide in the show notes. And thanks to my listeners for joining me, and thanks, Professor Fetzer, for also joining me today.
My great pleasure, David. Thank you.
Bye-bye.